In Visalia, they know him as Mr. Oak, but he never would have earned that distinction if he hadn't survived a very close call aboard his aircraft carrier in World War II.
If I hadn't been down on the deck, I wouldn't be here today, Paul. My lucky day, I guess the good Lord was looking after me.
Tune into Hometown Heroes and you'll find out why this Purple Heart recipient feels that way. Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you listen to us on the AM side of the dial or the FM area, maybe even online at kmjnow.com, hopefully you figured out what this show is all about. It's about letting our veterans know how much we appreciate what they've done for us. We want to honor them for their service, for their sacrifices. We want to make sure that their stories are not forgotten. We want these tales to be preserved for posterity so the rest of us can learn, and we'll be learning along the way today with 87-year-old Alan George of Visalia, a lifelong resident of Visalia. In fact, I understand they call you Mr. Oak down here. Where did that come from?
Well, Paul, I guess it's because one of my pet interests is preserving our valley oak trees, and I've had quite an interesting about trying to do that. I've planted hundreds and hundreds of oak trees, and we've got an ordinance passed that preserves the oaks. You have to have a permit to take them out, and so I just love this area. And of course, one of the strong points of Visalia is the valley oak, and we're planting lots of them now. We don't have as many as we used to have, of course, because they're at one time, there was 50,000 acres of oaks, valley oaks, in the area where Visalia City is now. So we're down to just a few trees here and there. But we have a group of people that are planting oaks along some of the creeks and waterways of the area. So we're improving our situation.
Well, that explains the acorn I saw on your front door when I walked in. And I'm curious to know about your history of trumpeting the Valley Oak and its history and the importance of preserving it. Anytime you drive south on the 99 through the city of Visalia, right when you come to the edge of town, you see a big sign that says Visalia and has a big oak tree next to it. Did you have anything to do with that?
Probably. I guess one of my claims to fame is getting the Nature Conservancy to buy 324 acres of oaks out about 6 miles east of Visalia. We called it Cuy Oak Preserve. We were able to get that through a bunch of things that worked out for us, and fortunately the lady that inherited the property wanted to farm it, and I talked her into preserving it. So one of the highlights of my life was getting that preserved.
Well, we've heard of Johnny Appleseed, and today we're talking to Mr. Oak, but he never would have had a chance to become Mr. Oak here in Tulare County if he didn't make it through World War II. And I've seen a piece of shrapnel that tells me that was beating some odds to make it through World War II. We're going to get that story today from Alan, who was just a teenager when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And I understand you were ditching church that morning?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I'm a big band fan. And there was a program on Sunday morning that came out of L.A. I don't even remember the station's name now, but I didn't go to church or Sunday school that Sunday, and I was listening to some of the big band music, and they interrupted the broadcast of the music and announced the attack of Pearl Harbor. So I was in high school at that time, and I graduated shortly after that and joined the Navy when I was 18. My folks wouldn't sign for me at 17, so I had to wait till I was 18.
So when the Pearl Harbor attacks happened, you were a senior in high school at Visalia High School, where the Redwood High campus is now. And I imagine a lot of your classmates did try to sign up right away.
Yeah, we had a tremendous bunch of volunteers. Everything was volunteer at that time. And most of our class were a few that had handicapped medical reasons for not being able to join the service, but we were all in the service within a few months of our graduation. We're very fortunate, though. We only lost three of our high school classmates in World War II, so we were blessed from that standpoint.
Well, and we're going to hear the story of how you almost became number four on that list. I'm very glad that you didn't. And I want to understand a little bit more, too, about what Visalia was like, because I'm sure you, as someone who's lived in this city your whole life, have a very interesting perspective on the way this city has changed over the years. How did the news of America being at war resonate throughout Visalia? What were some of the things that you observed here after that?
We had a lot of Japanese in our high school, and we were very good friends. We just thought those were the greatest young people, and they were very good students. After Pearl Harbor, why they rounded up all these people and had to put them in a I guess they call them a different name than concentration camps, but that's what they really were. And we felt that was one of the toughest things about the war at that time, was the losing of our friends. They didn't even get to graduate with us. They declared martial law, and so they couldn't even hardly go out. I know one of our Japanese friends, some of my high school friends, took him up and down Main Street, and they told him to get down Moss because we don't want anybody to see you. But they were great people, and we felt their loss. And they were the most loyal people you'd ever want to ask. That 442nd Division in the Army, their record is just unbeatable. So they were true patriots just like we were. But unfortunately, the President Roosevelt and his infant wisdom just didn't see it that way, I guess.
Well, you've just given us a good taste of history. And, of course, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team did go on to serve with great distinction at great loss made up of Japanese-American soldiers. You decided that you wanted to be in the Navy. Why the Navy? Was it because you couldn't get enough water around Visalia or what?
Well, I've always loved ships. And when I was young, I used to build all kinds of ship models, mostly Navy ships, and that was one of the reasons. And then I had a couple older friends of mine that joined the Navy even before Pearl Harbor. Two of them are people I just worshiped the ground they walked on, so that was an incentive for me to want to join the Navy. But I just love ships. I can remember as a small boy my folks taking me out to either see the Saratoga or the Lexington when she was anchored out in the San Francisco Bay, and we tendered out there to see her, and I think one of my parents' friends was in the Navy, and he was aboard that ship, so he was able to set it up to where we could go out there and visit. So I just love to be on the water. Joanne and I, my wife, we've been on many, many cruises, and being on the water is a real turns me on.
Well, yeah, a cruise is a lot different than having Japanese guns and kamikazes pointed at you. But long before you got out in the Pacific, you sign up for the Navy, and you probably thought there was going to be some cruising in the sunshine going on here. But the first place they sent you is snowy Idaho. Is that right?
That's right, Paul. Farragut, Idaho. I have two things that almost killed me during World War II. One was in boot camp at Farragut. We were out guarding garbage cans at 20 below zero, and that just isn't an ideal situation for somebody raised in the San Joaquin Valley. So I spent 4 months in the hospital up there. I had pneumonia and pleurisy and scarlet fever and a ruptured ear all at the same time. And I can remember going in the hospital, and I don't remember anything for 3 days. And when I woke up, I looked out, and here was a head nurse and the commandant of the hospital looking in the isolation ward where I was with scarlet fever, and I guess they were glad to see that I had survived, and I had a wonderful doctor up there too, so I give him credit for saving my life, and the care up there was fantastic.
Well, wow, I mean, I hear you say that, and I imagine 4 months in a hospital, and what made you believe that you'd actually get out of there and actually serve in this Navy? Because to that point, that had to be pretty demoralizing.
Yes, it was. I had to blow on paper bags for several months to get my left lung inflated again, just with wonderful care and incentive to want to make it through. I was able to get released after 4 months in the hospital and join a different company, of course, and graduate with a different company, and then go on to finish my career in the Navy during World War II and the end of World War II.
Have you ever pondered what would have been different had you not faced all those health issues? Had you been able to complete your training in Farragut at the right time, you think you would have been on another ship and maybe suffered a different fate?
Well, I think that's very likely, yes, because at that time we weren't doing very good in World War II. We were, until the Battle of Midway, well, we were Battle of Santa Cruz, we didn't do very well. So, but they were grinding them out pretty fast in boot camp. So if I'd have stayed with my original company, which was Company 443, I would have been out, about 4 months or 5 months sooner. Of course, I went through the electronic program. That was a year's training, so I would have probably been on a very different ship. But I like carrier duty, and that was a very interesting duty.
Yeah, let's hear about that. And tell me about the specific duties that you ended up with on your carrier, the USS Bataan, CVL-29.
Well, I was a radio technician, and when I went aboard, I was third-class petty officer, and our job was to maintain the electronic equipment. We had a system called the TBS electronic system, which was the radio was only good for line of sight, so the enemy couldn't detect the transmission. So that was good, and that was very important to maintain that equipment. We used to have to clean the insulators because they'd get soot and stuff on them, and they'd arc a lot of times, so we'd have to go up there and way up there over the water, probably, 70, 80 feet at least, and with the ship rocking back and forth, way, we had to clean those insulators. So that was pretty exciting. But after I made second class petty officer, I didn't do that anymore. I let somebody else do it. But then one of our other jobs was when the planes would take off or land, we had these great big huge antenna poles, and we'd have to crank them by hand, and we'd be on both ends of the transmission line, and if we get out of sync, I remember one time we did get out of sync, and the skipper up there on the bridge yelled out, "Get those poles right up there, right." So, but it was a kind of a, it wasn't a fun job. We used to have to do that, but we had a good life, and we did what we had to do, and sometimes it was a real challenge to make the equipment work, but I guess we survived.
I imagine sometimes when you see what we have today, and maybe your grandson talks to you about his cell phone or his iPad or iPhone or whatever, that you marvel at how far technology has come from the high-tech electronics you had on that aircraft carrier?
Yeah, you got that right. I don't even have a computer. So, it's been a vast change, and after I got out, I didn't like electronics. So I wanted to get into agriculture, which I did. But my wife takes care of most of the problems with the electronics. I don't even like to touch them or look at them anymore. She makes sure everything's working, though.
Well, back then, you were the one that had to make sure that equipment was working so you guys could stay in communication. And being on an aircraft carrier, did you ever feel like you guys were a target because of the significance of your ship compared to smaller ones?
Well, actually, The aircraft carriers were the primary target of the Japanese Air Corps, and kamikazes, that was the number one target for them. And so we had tremendous losses through the kamikaze system. And unfortunately for the Japanese, we had around Kyushu, Japan, that's where the kamikazes were centered, we had these picket destroyers all around the island. And so when the kamikazes would take off, the pickets would warn us they were coming. So our CAP, or Combat Air Patrol, would take off and intercept them. So we had a pretty good system, but we took some tremendous losses. As you well know, you've interviewed some of the people that have been on some of the other ships. The carriers were the number one target.
Well, we're going to hear about experiences when your ship was targeted by kamikazes, as well as that moment where you were wounded and the reason that you have a Purple Heart today. We need to take our first commercial break. We'll come back with more from Visalia's Alan George. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
That bed, I heard my wife say, in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up, she didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with 87-year-old Alan George of Visalia, a Navy veteran of World War II and a recipient of the Purple Heart. In fact, if you go to our website at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you can see a picture of young Alan George getting that Purple Heart pinned on his perfectly white Navy uniform back in 1945. And when that happened, there was an article in the Visalia Times Delta, and Mr. George has a copy of that article from way back in 1945. I'm going to read it to you before we proceed here. The headline says, Alan George aboard Carrier Bataan receives Purple Heart on 21st birthday. And here's the article. A birthday party staged by the United States Navy. His gift, the handsome Purple Heart Medal, was the experience of Alan Gibson George, son of Mr. and Mrs. Faber George of 1500 West Myrtle, who was 21 years old on October 6th. Aboard the aircraft carrier USS Bataan, George is now en route to the Providence, Rhode Island Navy Yard, where his carrier will take part in Navy Day celebrations. The birthday party took place October 6th as the carrier entered the Panama Canal. In what the 21-year-old sailor described as, quote, very nice ceremonies, the captain presented him with the Purple Heart for shrapnel wounds received May 14th off Okinawa. In a letter to his mother, George said, quote, it is quite a privilege to wear it. Lots of mothers may have the medal, but not the son it represents. I know of quite a few that will never return. I shall never forget the day after we were hit and they had the burial at sea. So that was the quote from 1945. The article continues, but I'm going to pick up there with Alan George. And I'm sure just hearing those words that you spoke all those years ago brings back some memories that I want to touch on. But before we get to your being wounded, tell me about your first taste of combat, when that moment came that you realized this is it. This is serious business, and I'm in pretty grave danger here.
Well, we were forming up our task groups or task force into four groups, and there used to be two CVs, which are the big carriers, and then two CVLs in each of the groups. And then at that time, we were under Mark Mitcher, who was head of Task Group 58. So we teamed up there in Ulithi, and then we went out to sea. And on April 1st, 1945, they called it Love Day. That was when we invaded the Battle of Okinawa. So that was pretty exciting for all of us that had never been in combat before. So we started the battle, and it lasted for 80 days, which was one of the longest battles of World War II. And we didn't see land for 80 days, and so we were glad to get closer to where we could see some land finally.
When that action started, what was the role of your ship, and what were you doing on that ship? I'm sure your adrenaline was pumping a little bit.
Yeah, it was. I used to worry at night when I'd hit my rack after being on watch. I was always afraid we might hit one of those mines out there at sea, and I've seen the destroyers go up near them and fire their 5-inch guns at them and explode. And boy, what a big wad of water goes up in the air from the mines. But anyway, we'd go on watch for 4 hours, and then 4 hours on and 4 hours off. And sometimes those night watches were pretty long. And we used to sit in our radio shack there, and we had a squawk box. And if they needed any radio technicians, a little light would light up. And I can remember praying and hoping that the light would never light up, because that meant we had to go up into CIC and work on some of the electronic equipment with all the officers and everything. And some of the sailors up there were charting the task force and the kamikazes that were flying in toward us and all that. So we survived, and something I was glad I could be involved in, but I'm glad I survived it too.
And what was your duty station?
I was in Radio Shack too. That's where I got the 5-inch shell over my head, and that was where several of us were stationed at a time to take care of any problems that we had in communication with all the other ships in the task force. But fortunately, we were right next to the bakery, and Armed Forces had a beautiful system of recording big band music, and we used to have charge of those records. So, and the bakers liked that music as well as we did, so we used to trade them a loan of records for eggs, and we'd have our eggs on mid watches get us through the night. But it was a good system, and it worked good.
Simple pleasures while you're at war. Do you remember the first time that you found out firsthand what a kamikaze was and what it was capable of?
We were operating, as I've mentioned before, in a task group where there's used two of the big carriers and then two of our smaller light fast carriers, CVLs. We were right beside the Franklin when she was hit. That was probably the most damaged ship in World War II that actually survived. They brought her clear home from the Japanese islands, and she came back and they rebuilt her, but they didn't finish restoration of the Franklin until the war was just about over, so she never got back into combat. But it's an interesting story, and we were so close as a task group that we almost collided with the Franklin when she was hit, but we had pretty good people on the helm up there on the bridge, so they were able to avoid a collision.
Yeah, the Franklin is kind of the poster child for kamikaze attacks in World War II, but your ship obviously was targeted, and just because the kamikaze didn't get you, I'm sure the kamikazes were trying to hit your ship, and you probably were in a great deal of fear, or at least concern, that this could happen. How did you deal with that kind of ever-present danger?
As I've indicated before, we were always scared. For those of us below decks where we couldn't see what was going on, we had a person on the microphone up on the bridge that described what was going on. I can remember one time he was telling us about this plane that was diving on us, and he said, I could see the red meatball on the wing, and I can see the pilot. And he says, oh, he's dropping a bomb on us. And we just stayed there and waited and wondered what was going to happen. And pretty soon he says, oh, he missed. And so we felt pretty good about that. I guess that was the closest experience we had until we had the 4 or 5-inch shells come on the port side of our ship. Believe it or not, that was from American ships that were tracking on a kamikaze plane, and they got down so low, and they still tracked on the plane and fired 4 5-inch shells, and those are what hit our ship.
Well, and this was the incident that left you wounded and with this piece of shrapnel. In fact, I saw your Purple Heart box on the table. I could tell that was the box your Purple Heart came in, and I expected to see the Purple Heart inside, but you've got a little piece of shrapnel in there. Tell me what you remember about. That was, what, May 14th of 45?
Yes. All I can remember is that if I hadn't been down on the deck, I wouldn't be here today, Paul, and that was my lucky day. And I guess one of the saddest things out of that incident and some of the other ones that we experienced was a burial at sea. They put the deceased in a coffin, and then they weighed it down with a shell, and then they have a little deal on the side of the ship where it's kind of a trough type of deal where they can take the coffin and they slide it into the sea, and then they play taps. And if you haven't experienced that, well, I'm glad you haven't, because it's very, very sad to think you've lost a shipmate, and that's what they have to do, is bury him out at sea.
Well, and as you say that, I think back to that quote that I read from the Visalia Times Delta back in 1945, and relaying the information to your hometown about the fact that you were wounded. And you were quoted in that article, "Lots of mothers may have the medal, but not the son it represents. I know of quite a few that will never return, and I shall never forget the day after we were hit and they had the burial at sea." So it was etched in your mind that day, and I think I hear between the words that you're saying a sentiment that not only your heart goes out to those who lost loved ones, but that it was real easy to picture yourself in one of those coffins being buried at sea.
That's right. I guess the good Lord was looking over my shoulder at that time, or I wouldn't have been flat on the deck. Then the other thing that comes to my mind is that a lot of us wouldn't be here today if they hadn't dropped the atomic bomb in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, because after we spent a month in the Philippine Islands for R&R, why, then we were preparing our ships for the invasion of Japan.
Let me cut you off, because I don't want you to get away without telling us the whole story of May 14th. I don't think you're deliberately trying to avoid it, but we want to hear what happened so we can see through our eyes and our imagination what you experienced that day. You talked about hitting the deck. You're in this radio shack, right?
Yes, I can remember getting hit, and it wasn't very long that some of my compatriots came in and picked me up and carried me out of there and took me down to sick bay, because I was bleeding some, and hospital corpsmen and the surgeons that we had on our ship were wonderful, and I had that shrapnel dug out either that day or the next day, I don't remember now, but it didn't take very long, and I was back on duty in a couple days. So it just shows you how those people are trained to take care of those of us that have the misfortune of being wounded. We had, at the time of the 4 5-inch shells coming into our port side of our ship, we lost 8 people that day and 26 wounded. So I was one of the lucky ones, and one of my friends from junior college, he was wounded the same day. He was a hospital corpsman, and he survived just like I did, and we went on the same carrier the same day, and then after the end of the war, we both wound up at UC Davis at the same time. But he's deceased now.
Some real parallels there. So you're talking about these 5-inch shells coming through the port side of your ship. Did you hear something, feel something? What prompted you to hit the deck, as you say?
Well, we'd been at battle stations for a long time, and we were all very tired, so I won't admit it, but I may have been sleeping. But that's okay. I mean, at general quarters, because we were at general quarters for a long time, and you get kind of tired and worn out, and pressure, of course, takes hold. And I guess it was the next day, and here was a destroyer going alongside our ship, smoothing out the water so we wouldn't take any more water in the ship, because at the elevation that the shell came in the ship, it was right at the water line, so they had to take that precaution to keep the water from coming into the ship. So after I looked at that hole in there, and I really counted my blessings, because that was a great big huge hole, and to think that I was flat on the deck and only wound up with some shrapnel, why, I guess the good Lord was looking after me.
No doubt, and I hear you saying that you might feel a little embarrassed if you were indeed sleeping, if you had just given into sheer exhaustion and passed out there, but I also hear you saying that if that's what happened, it probably saved your life, that if you were sitting somewhere or upright, that it may have cost you your life?
That's right, yeah. We had one officer that just came aboard ship. I don't know, he must have had some kind of an inkling that that shell was coming, because he was out of the radio shack before the shell even hit. So he survived that too. But yeah, I guess there was only a couple of us in the radio shack at the time that shell hit us. Nobody was killed in there, and I was the only one wounded.
Where were you hit on your body, and what did it feel like?
Well, I was hit in my chest and my leg and my arm. I still have a little bit of a scar, some scars left, but not very much. In the 60-some years that it happened ago, they pretty well healed. So I probably have more problems from my experience in boot camp with pneumonia and my lung than than happened to me from wounding.
It is somewhat impressive that in such a chaotic situation on such a gigantic ship with so much going on that you were able to bring back that piece of shrapnel. That was kind of them to give it to you. When you open up that box now and you see that little rusted hunk of iron, what does it represent to you? What does it make you think of?
It makes me think of how lucky I am. But, yeah, it's I was very privileged to get the Purple Heart. A lot of people that got the Purple Heart didn't become part of the Greatest Generation. They just didn't survive. Anyway, very lucky.
And I'm sure at the time you thought this was enemy fire that had wounded you. When did you realize that it was actually an American ship's shells?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know exactly how to answer it because I didn't read about it till later. I guess it makes sense that the kamikaze didn't hit us, and I think it was at one of the battleships, as near as I could tell, that was tracking on the kamikaze that was coming in toward us. They were trying to get it before it got us, but they got us instead of the kamikaze.
And did it have any impact on how you felt about it, knowing that it was most likely American fire that left you with these wounds and that special souvenir you have over there as opposed to enemy fire? Did that make any difference in your mind?
Well, I guess not, because those are the things that happen in war. I can remember being up in CIC, which is our communications center on our ship, and some of the pilots that were up there coming in to land didn't turn on their IFF, which is identification friend or foe, and they kept saying, quit shooting at us because you're going to hit us. And we'd radio back and say, well, turn on your IFF if you want to survive. So, you know, those things happen in war, and I guess the gun that was tracking on the kamikaze must have been on automatic or something because it didn't know the difference.
Well, we're just thankful you live to tell about it and that we have time for you to tell us more. Right back with 87-year-old Navy veteran Alan George when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M flying wing, forerunner of the B-2 stealth bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso. Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 87-year-old Purple Heart recipient Alan George of Visalia, our guest. He told us about that fateful day, May 14th, 1945, when he was wounded off of Okinawa as he served aboard the USS Bataan, a carrier that had been given that name in 1943 2 years before Allied forces would recapture the Bataan Peninsula, where 15,000 Americans and more than 60,000 Filipinos had been forced into what has lived in infamy as the Bataan Death March. The Vice President of the Philippines was there when the Bataan was commissioned. Alan George wasn't there yet, but he was aboard ship for that marathon Battle of Okinawa from the first day of April to the 21st of June in 1945. And Alan, I'm guessing that when that battle finally came to an end, it had to be a pretty big relief.
Oh, yeah, we were pretty excited when they ceased the battle, and then we were able to get 30-day R&R down in the Philippines, and that was quite a nice break. They got to go ashore and have a couple cans of beer and go back to the ship. But we were down there for about a month, so it was a nice respite from battle. And, 80 days at sea is a long time. You didn't see any land, and people that developed the system had a wonderful system of we'd be out for 3 days off the coast of Japan with our pilots, and a carrier like a landing field, actually. So they fly off the ship and then come back. After you're out 3 or 4 days, well, you had to have these supply ships come out and top off our fuel and give us some new ammunition and provisions. So it lasted about 3 or 4 days, and then we'd go further away from Japan and resupply and then get ready to go back again.
And you started to take me there when I cut you off, but you really feel that the atomic bombs, and I've had so many veterans tell me this because they would have been part of the invasion force attacking Japan, but you feel like that may have spared your life? That was a big relief, big moment for you?
Absolutely. We were some of the first ships into Tokyo Bay after the end of the war, and one of the stipulations was that they had to put white sheets or white flags up around all their gun emplacements. When we went into Tokyo Bay, we went by Mount Fujiyama and all that, but it was just solid white. They said that we would have lost 1 million men if we'd had to invade Japan, and I'm sure I could have more than likely been one of those. So thanks to President Truman why we dropped the atomic bomb. And that it took two of them, though, to unfortunately for the Japanese, it took two of them to decide that they didn't want to continue. That was quite an experience going into Tokyo Bay, because I can remember we were berthed at one of the Japanese naval bases there. And, of course, you had to be over 6 feet tall to be in the parties that went ashore from our ship, and I didn't qualify. So all I could see was through the ship binoculars up on the bridge what was going on. But we had some big Marines on our ship, and they were pretty good-sized men. And then some of my colleagues went ashore. They came back with some nice souvenirs, which we weren't able to get.
Did you understand the rationale for you had to be at least 6 feet to go ashore? Was it intimidation purposes or what?
Absolutely. They were trying to impress the Japanese that we were a super race. And we didn't think at the when we first started fighting the Japanese, we pictured them as little short people with Coke bottle eyes and all that. And we didn't realize how tenacious fighters they really were.
So after that all happens, and the war ended 67 years ago this week, I suppose, we're at that time of year. But then before you make it back to the States, your birthday is rolling around. You turn 21 on October 6, 1945, and they surprise you with this Purple Heart? You didn't know this was going to happen, did you?
Not really. I was kind of hoping I'd get one for being wounded, but actually, to think that the article would indicate the Navy did that especially for me isn't factual at all, because the Navy doesn't do things like that. But
you know those media types, they like to make it special.
It sounded good anyway, and it was good copy for the local people, and I guess for me too. But the Navy just doesn't have celebrations like that. And there were, I think I said 26 that were wounded, so there were 26 Purple Hearts that were given out that day for all of us that were wounded.
And was there some special significance for you to be aboard your ship receiving that with those other guys? Did that make it more meaningful, you think?
I guess it indicated that we'd done what we were supposed to do, and I guess that we were in the wrong places at the right time to have that happen. But, we appreciate the government supporting us by issuing these Purple Hearts. There's an interesting story about the Purple Heart and how it was created, I think, during the Civil War. So I think that you were given one of those as a result of something that you did in the service was, you know, it's a great gesture.
Well, and it's a very small percentage of Americans who have received the Purple Heart. It's a much smaller percentage who got that Purple Heart on their birthday. So you have quite the claim to fame there. The other thing that strikes me about your ship, its name, did that hold any special significance to you, knowing what had happened earlier in the war?
Early in the war, while we were pretty short of carriers, so they took 9 light cruisers and converted them into CVLs, or light carriers, and they were considered light, fast carriers, and we were a combat ship, not a like a CVE, which we were supply carriers. But the name Bataan certainly meant a lot to those of us, because that was probably one of the most, well, it was the most recognized thing that was done in Corregidor and Bataan during World War II. To think those people suffered that long and were able to hold out for so many days that they did, with limited provisions and limited ammunition and all that, why, it's just amazing that, and we were proud of the name of our ship. I know whenever I go on a cruise, we have a lot of Filipino people wait on us on these cruises, and when they see my ship name on my hat, Bataan, boy, they come rushing over and they give us a special service, because all the Filipino people are so gracious and appreciate what we did for them during the war.
As well they should. And you know, obviously the whole country at that time had Remember Pearl Harbor as that refrain to motivate them. But as I heard you talking about being on the Bataan, I had imagined maybe you would think of those suffering on the Bataan death march and have some righteous anger. But it sounds like in addition to that, you were inspired by how long those American forces held out in those conditions. Not necessarily just anger at the Japanese, but inspiration from your fellow Americans. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, that's right. The odds were very strongly stacked against them. And of course, MacArthur, he had to leave to go to Australia. And his famous saying was, "I shall return," which he did later on. But the Filipino people are very gracious people. They have a strong bond with Americans.
And as for your story, you got your Purple Heart after the war had ended, but you weren't home yet. What did it feel like when you finally did get home and you got to come back to Visalia and see your folks again?
Well, it was a long time before I saw my folks after I came back. We went to pick up troops in Buckner Bay. General Buckner was killed during the war, and we picked up some of those people to bring them home. It's hard to relate to, but we had the most glorious return home. We went into New York Harbor at the end of the war, and I can remember all the fireboats out there spraying water, and they had singing groups come out on little boats, tugboats, to sing for us. I can remember, I think we had the Andrews Sister come out there, and I heard Sentimental Journey, they sang that, and It Might As Well Be Spring, and those are two songs I'd never heard before, and I just love those songs now. But we had signs all over New York City that says, "Welcome home, well done." And when we got ashore, why, people just couldn't be any better to us than they were. It's kind of ironic. My first Liberty in New York, I ran into one of my good friends down in Times Square, and we had a nice time together. And then my second Liberty in New York City, I ran into another Visalian. So I guess the Visalians get around a little bit too. But it was kind of a nice experience. But they couldn't have been any better to us. Then we went from New York City just a few days later up to Providence, Rhode Island for Navy Day. We were the only combat ship at Providence. We had thousands of people lined up to go aboard ship because they wanted to see what a combat carrier looked like. And I can remember some of these girls that would be lined up. They'd say, "Hey, sailor, how about taking me aboard your ship and show me around?" I said, "Well, we don't have time for that. We got Liberty." There were so many people wanting to go aboard the Bataan that they had to turn the fire hose on them to keep them from falling in the bay. So I guess we had a real winter there. And then we went into dry dock shortly after that in Boston for a month. And then they converted our ship over to a troop carrier.
And I understand you even took a voyage ferrying some Italian POWs back and bringing some American GIs home. But you talk about young ladies and those that wanted to get on the ship. What about the young lady you ended up marrying? Is it safe to say that you and Joanne never would have met had that shrapnel been a little worse on May 14th of 45?
I don't know. It's hard to say, but I know her folks are a long time Tulare people, and she grew up there. We had a friend of ours, mutual friend, set me up on a blind date, and I can remember that cute little redheaded girl answering the door when I came, and we couldn't go out together because her folks were, she was just 17 and ready to turn 18, and her folks were a little leery about a combat Navy veteran going out with her daughter, so we had to have dinner at their house, and then I think we went to the local swimming pool for our first date, but it worked out right. I don't know if the Purple Heart or whatever had anything to do with it or not, but of course she wasn't in the radar at that time, but later on she was an important part of it.
Yeah, after 62 years of marriage, I'd say so, and two children and a grandson that never would have been born if you and Joanne hadn't got together, and that would have never happened if you didn't survive that day at sea on the USS Bataan. And you come back to your hometown, and obviously you have a lot of pride in being a Visalian. Here's your platform. What gives you the most pride about calling Visalia your hometown? What's so special about this place?
Well, it's a beautiful area. I have a lot of friends here. You know, having grown up here, one of my friends said when I was introduced recently for an award, he said Alan was born in 1924, and when he was a little boy, he played cowboy and Indians, and they were real Indians. So I have to laugh about that, but it's just a special area. I've been well rewarded by different things in the past and present for all the things I've been able to do. You know, having worked in agriculture and through the University of California, I couldn't ask for a better career than what I had after I did get out of the Navy. I graduated from Cal in 1950, and I was trying to find a job, and they just weren't very plentiful. So I looked all over. I went, beat the pavement in San Francisco with some of the companies up there that were involved in agriculture, and nothing much happened as of it. But then the Korean War came along in 1950, so then I had a chance for three jobs, and I really wanted to be a farm advisor, so I pestered them enough to think that they hired me just to get rid of me. But it was the right decision to make, and I started out in Yuba City, California, and then I guess I was the first local person to be hired in the county that they grew up in. So I had 34 years as cotton farm advisor here in Tulare County, so I enjoyed my work very much.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people that you worked with over the years that are probably listening to you right now. When you think about the men that you served with, all the people that that you encountered in the Navy, those who came home, those who didn't come home, what gives you the most satisfaction, the most pride in being able to call yourself a World War II veteran?
I guess one of the things I'd have to say is most of my peers are no longer living, so I guess I have to say that I must have done something right, or Joanna did something right for me to live as long as I have. We have ship reunions every year, and they have them in different areas of the United States. All the ones I was close to are all deceased now, so I don't even bother to go anymore, because most of the people that go to the reunions are Korean War veterans. They did take our ship out of mothballs. We put her in mothballs in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and then during the Korean War, they put the ship back in commission, and she was in the Korean War, but most of the people that go to the reunions now are Korean veterans. And then there's a brand new aircraft carrier called the USS Bataan. It's a helicopter carrier, and they just put it into service a couple years ago, and we were invited back to a special recognition day being on the original Bataan. I didn't know the Navy could cook chicken as good as they do now. But anyway, my son and grandson both decided they wanted to go too, so they came, and we had a nice time, and I never saw so much gold braid around us listening to our stories about the kamikazes and the World War II as the people on the present USS Bataan. Anyway, the legacy continues.
Well, and speaking of legacies, you have been very involved in preserving the history of this area, obviously the preservation with the Valley Oak as well. But another thing that Visalia has done well is honor veterans and try to preserve their legacy. There's a giant mural on Mooney Boulevard that depicts different scenes from World War II with the caption, "The Greatest Generation." You've gone out to that mural and spoken to school children about some of your experiences. Why is that important to you? Why do you think those of us who did not live through World War II need to know about it and need to know what happened?
Well, I think there's a real gap in communications today in the school system. They don't seem to recognize what's gone on ahead as far as World War II. And I know even the Smithsonian Institute, for example, they wanted to put on this display about the atomic bomb, and they wanted to issue a stamp on the atomic bomb, and they were turned down for that. So, you know, there's a lack of appreciation of World War II. I guess one of the things that impressed me was, like you have indicated, Paul, that we go out to the schools and talk to the kids about our experiences. One time I took as a guest one of the veterans from the Vietnam, and when we got through, he said, "I'd like to say something." So he stood up in front of all these people that were out there, and he says, "You know, this is the nicest thing, the recognition that you people have done in the school, not only recognizing World War II veterans, but also what we did, too, for our country." So, you know, I really appreciate that. It brought tears to my eyes to think that we had ignored those people that sacrificed just like we did. We had the greatest homecoming any group could ever have at the end of World War II. And to think these people have been ignored for so long, I think it's finally being rectified to some extent, but it's taken a long time.
I'm glad you brought that up, because coming up on September 8th in Clovis, they're having a big parade and a special event to honor both veterans from the Vietnam era and those who are back from Iraq and Afghanistan. They're going to have a parade beginning and ending at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District building. Food and entertainment there, even a job and resource fair for veterans. That is September 8th, a Saturday. I'm going to be up in Oregon with the Bulldog football team, but I hope that you'll be there in Clovis, and I do have that information for you on our website at kmjnow.com. We're about out of time on the program, but I want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for taking some shrapnel for us. Thank you for telling us all about it. Is there anything else that you want us to know?
I think you're doing a great service, Paul, and I have a lot of friends that listen to your program, so keep up the good work, and we appreciate KMJ supporting such a program, because I hadn't heard about it till not too long ago, and I won't miss any of your programs if I am in range of the radio station. I know we were up in Chico recently, and I was hoping we'd get down close enough to KMJ on a Saturday to listen to your program, but we didn't quite make it. But anyway, it's a great service. Thank you for what you're doing as well as what we did 60-some years ago.
Well, the privilege is absolutely all mine, and I hope all those friends of yours are still listening after they hear you on the show.
Well, I don't know. I might turn them off. I know I'll probably get a lot of heckling over it.
Well, I think that phone is about to start ringing now. Head over to kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see some photos of Alan George then and now. And join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.